Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Marie Kelly from Northeast Philly.
Hi, everyone. I'm Marie Kelly, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's nice to be here. I hope that everybody had a good holiday. It was an interesting car ride. I made amends on the way because they were late. I have a sober date. My sober date is June 1st, 2007. I have a sponsor, and her name is Beverly, and she is a sponsor. And I also have a home group, which is Ron and Dittman, and we meet every Wednesday night, and it is a step study through the big book. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous since 1987, and I have 4.5 years sober. So I missed a little something along the way. I stand here for two reasons and two reasons only. I received a gift of desperation, and because of a loving God that I did not believe in, and I was very, very angry with. At one time, I had 14 years of continuous sobriety and relapsed. And I could probably stand here all night and tell you about the progression of this disease. Wanting to be sober will not get us sober or keep us sober. I wanted to be sober and could not get back. The problem is I didn't understand what the problem was. I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia. I still live there. And growing up, I always didn't feel right. It was like everybody out there had this right world, and I was in the wrong world. I had two parents. They gave us everything. There were four children in our family, went to Catholic school. But I never really felt comfortable even in my family. I just thought like my parents were wrong. They had the better parents. I just never really felt right. Had a lot of friends, was on student council, went to Archbishop Ryan, had all this. I was on a really good women's soccer team. And my mom always used to say to me, "You're so popular. You have so many friends." But I always felt, always felt alone and didn't know why. And I was scared to death of everything. Just always petrified, just fear that would keep me up during the night and didn't even know what I was afraid of. I probably took my first drink. I was around 13 years old, and, I just had that feeling. Like, this was absolutely the answer to everything. Now, all of a sudden, all the people that I thought didn't like me, I liked them. They liked me. We were all good. Everything was good. I could be in a crowd of, 10 women, and my head would just constantly say, "I am absolutely the ugliest girl here. No one likes me, and they don't even want me here." You know, you put a drink in me, and I fit in with the world. I was okay with me. And that's how it went. And I drank a lot, and I could drink a lot. And I remember the football team used to make fun of me. I was a cheerleader before I became a soccer player. I liked soccer much better than cheerleading. And they would make fun of me. You know, they would say, like, "You can drink so much for a girl," you know. And it was that whole thing of once I took one, I would always say, "I'm only going to have three." Now, once I put a drink in me, like, I didn't stop, and I didn't want to stop, and I didn't care. I did not care. They made fun of me and said, "You drink double of what we're drinking." And I remember going out with my sister, and my sister's not an alcoholic. And she would say stuff like, "It's 12 o'clock, we have to leave." And I would say, "I'm not leaving, get a ride." "Well, but you promised Mom and Dad." It didn't matter. Once it was in me, it was like that saying that you take a drink, the drink takes the drink, and then the drink takes the man. I was just off. All bets were off, and it didn't matter if I'd work the next day. And that's how my drinking went, and it didn't matter when I had children. You know, I remember my two best friends, and we were just talking about this. We all got pregnant at the same time. They stopped. After we had our children, they were just like, "We can't party anymore. We have children." My disease of perception, my idea was, why do we have to stop? They could stop. I suffer major consequences, and I don't stop anyway. I want to stop. I just don't know how to stay stopped and be comfortable in that. You know, I married a guy who drank like me, and you know, and I always picked guys who like had good jobs that like would take care of me and like would drink like me. So this guy had like a great job, and he was a soccer player, and he had a scholarship to college for soccer, and he had a job at UPS, and he would always say to me, "You were not that bad last night." And I married him because that's the guy that you need. That's the guy I needed in my corner, you know, because it was very evident very early on that I had a problem with alcohol. You know, now I come from a family that drinks. They like to party. And I, as the woman, I would be warned at the door separately by family members. Please don't carry on tonight. Please don't start. Marie, please behave. Now, if they're warning me, you know, and I wanted to behave, and I wanted to drink like a lady. I never drank like a lady. I drank like a sloppy, fallen down drunk. That's how I drank. And I suffered guilt, shame, and remorse, and I swore to God I wasn't going to do it again. And by Thursday, I couldn't wait till Friday because I have a mind that forgets. I forget. I can't recall that stuff. I can't recall the shame and the guilt and the pain and the embarrassment and people talking about you and saying, "Do you know what you did? Do you know who you went home with? Do you know that you crashed that car?" I've been to hospitals. I've had nurses making fun of me. It just was, it was always trouble. It was always trouble. And I'll tell you, when I got married, I was 21 years old the first time. I've been married twice. When I got married the first time, I never touched a drink on my wedding day because I already knew that if I touched a drink, I knew what was going to happen. And I didn't want to be that bride that everyone talked about. So I married him. That lasted about 4 years. And I had two children, and I was probably about 20, I don't know, 27, 28 years old. We split up. And I made my first AA meeting. I made AA in my 20s, but, you know, I thought I had a problem with alcohol, and I thought that I could still do those other recreational things that, you know, we think we can do. But my problem was alcohol. I went into Livengren in 1992. And I stayed 30 days. And that was my first rehab. I was actually away 13 times after I had 14 years of sobriety. So when I tell you that I couldn't get back, that's how many times I went away. So I went in Livengren and I came out. And, you know, I got in with a great, great group in Northeast Philadelphia. It was Summerton Noon Group. And there was another group, Octus. And we made a lot of meetings, and I want to say this. When I relapsed, I was very mad at those people. I had a major resentment because I felt that had I been introduced to the 12 steps, that wouldn't have happened, and I lost my family because of it. Today, I have a different understanding. I believe that that was my journey that God put me on, because now that I am in the solution, through God's grace, I've been able to help countless women. And I'm not mad anymore. That was my journey, and that's how it was supposed to go. But at the time, you know, we were making meetings, and we were encouraged to talk about our problems, not to get away from yourself. Talk about yourself. Go to the meeting and talk about it. You got to talk about it. Put your hand up and talk about it. And that's what we did. And I was told to do a step a year. You don't want to rush into that. Take it easy, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that means I'm going to have 12 years sober when I'm complete the 12 steps. And there were these steps on the wall, and they were confusing to me, and no one was really talking about them. And then they would say, well, why don't you make a step meeting a week? And I made a step meeting, but I was confused in AA. And I believe now that spiritual malady was getting worse, and I didn't know that. And I was sober about 2 years, and I met a man, and we got married, and he was absolutely the love of my life. We fell in love. We had absolutely a wonderful, wonderful marriage. I got hired with Amtrak. I had a very good job. He was a union carpenter. And at 38 years old, I had my third child. My child was a year old, and my child was diagnosed with a very, very aggressive pediatric cancer called neuroblastoma. And AA was awesome. They never left us. They were at the hospital all the time, but I was out of my mind with fear. But see, I didn't know any of this. I would talk to you and tell you that I believed in God, but I did not have reliance on God at all. And I found out there was a big difference. And I was encouraged to go to the meeting and talk about it. And what happened for me was I would go to the meeting and talk about it, and people would tell me things like, Marie Kelly, you're doing great. You're not drinking. And I believe them. See, I believe that. Look at all I'm going through. Oh, I'm going through a lot, and I'm not drinking. But then what would happen was, because I stayed with that fear and that problem, I would come home from the meeting, get on the phone, and keep talking about it. Then I would have to wake up tomorrow, go to another meeting, and keep talking about it. And I was totally living in the problem and not in the answer. I believe I drove my family crazy. I was, you know, scared to death that my son was going to relapse. There was only a 10% chance of his survival. And I'll just tell you that today he's 14 years old and he's 5'11". I don't like to leave that out because so many people come up and say, did your son live? But he did live. But I began a downward spiral sober. The problem is I'm sound asleep thinking I'm wide awake. I'm asleep in my life. I'm making decisions. I'm managing my husband. I'm managing the kids. I'm in AA. And how we sponsored people was we were like counselors, right? Marriage counselors, financial counselors, guidance counselors. They're a counselor. They would call you up and they would tell you. And I don't today, those people did the best they could. And they only taught and sponsored and helped how they were taught. But it was very ineffective in my life. And I have this desire and passion in my heart today, and I'm almost neurotic and crazy with it, that I don't ever want another human being in AA, whether you have 5 days sober sitting here or you have 20 years sober and you're on your way out that door, let's not get it confused. We don't have the qualification to tell anyone what to do with their life. We don't. I'm not qualified. But that's all we know at the time. So the sponsorship, really, for me sponsoring women was ineffective. It started to affect my marriage. My husband was like, you're always on the phone with these girls. You know, it took me away. It was not the correct way. And 12 years sober, I'm going to fast forward, 12 years sober, this man that I was in love with. Now, at this point, we're doing, you know, a reason why I talk about this, we had an amazing life. We had so much. We were in love with each other. Our marriage got better, not worse. We both made a lot of money, and husband number one was paying a huge chunk of money in child support. And I say that for a reason, because our reliance and dependence was on all that. There was no God. There wasn't. We might have talked about it, but it really wasn't going on the inside. And we had a summer home. We had a shore house. And what happened was I got a phone call one day that my husband was in a construction accident, and he was 150 feet in the air, and he was trapped. 500-pound pipes crushed his legs. And let me tell you, this was the downward spiral because, see, it talks about, you know, maintaining and building a spiritual life, right? Our big book talks about that all went well for a time. Right? And about self-sacrifice for others, that you're not going to be able to handle the low spots and trials that are coming. And they come for everyone. I'm not unique. I'm not standing up here to share this with you to go, oh, look what that girl went. It happens. It happens. And I wasn't ready for it. And our whole life changed. And husband number one stopped paying that child support. And my husband could no longer work, and he was in the hospital 6 months. And I gave up my job at Amtrak to take care of him. And 6 months later, he walked out on us. So there was this little party going on around the corner. And I had 14 years of sobriety. And I was slammed with grief depression that I couldn't even tell you. He left in April. I never sent my little boy to school. I could not function. I was paralyzed. I was restless, irritable, discontent. I was in so much pain. And I needed something. See, I didn't know that alcohol and those other things were my solution to my spiritual malady. I found out later on that God in the 12 steps is going to give me way more than what I chased my whole life. But I didn't know that. And what happened was, there was a party going on around the corner. And I knew what they were doing in there. And I went there. And I'll tell you that within a month, I never went back home. I had a daughter in LaSalle University. I had a boy that was graduating from Ryan. My husband came and took my son. And in that house, I met a guy who was a millionaire. And I was not drinking alcohol. I was doing something else. But let me tell you something. When that amount of money is involved and that amount of pain, because the pain that I was in was insurmountable, that I left my family. And I remember thinking, I got to go. I got to get back. I got to get back to AA. So these psychiatric hospitals and rehabilitation, and I was in Horsham Clinic 5 times. I was in Miremont 3 times. I was in Seabrook House. You know, they did the praying hands on me and Reiki and horse therapy. I mean, they tried to do everything, you know, like, let's try this, let's try that. But in between those rehabilitation, you know, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. Because here I am, you know, I start out 120 pounds. I'm 75 pounds. You know, I'm out of my mind. I want to see my children. My kids are like, you're our mother. Look what you're doing. Why are you doing this? And I'm saying to them, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart, I'm saying, I'm going to stop. I swear I'm going to stop. And my mom's saying, you almost could take a lie detector test. But see, at that moment, I meant it. But then what happens? I have a mind that forgets. I can't recall the pain. I can't recall that. I did horrible things, horrible, horrible things. My mother worked at a company for 27 years. They watched me pregnant with my first daughter. I went to my mother's company and I held my mother hostage. I told her that I had a gun. And I told her that she had to go to Mac. And if she didn't, the people that I had with me were going to kill me or kill her. These are the things that I did to my family. Because it takes us. It dictates who you're going with and what you're going to do. There are some of the things I did. I remember, you know, and again, people suffer consequences. There are people who their place of employment will say, you have a problem with alcohol, we want you to go away, and people go away, and then they come to AA and they can stop. I got custody papers saying Michael Kelly has been awarded custody of Michael Kelly. A normal, sane person who loved their children like I love my children would have said, that's it. I'm done. I went the other way because my pain was just too much. And you see, I couldn't come back to AA because the AA that I knew, they were saying, just sit down and sit on your hands and just hang in there. I'm in a mental obsession that is taking me the other way. I am in a compulsion that is absolutely, I can't stop. And they're just saying, meet me at the meeting tomorrow at noon. I'm thinking, tomorrow at noon, in an hour, I'm meeting Mr. Millionaire. I'm not going to make it to that meeting. So I felt like, AA, I had nowhere to go. Like, if you have nowhere to go, where do you go? And what happened was they sent me to a recovery house in Bristol, Pennsylvania. Now, this was about after the 6th or 7th rehab, and I was 45 years old, and they're sending me. That my mother said, we're taking your keys off you, and we're taking your car. This is from my own home. They won't let me go back to my own home. And you're going to go to this recovery house. And in that recovery house, there was a woman in there who today is still my sponsor. Now, she is 23 years younger than me. And I got to this recovery house, and, you know, I'm driving up there, and I'm thinking, well, I had 14 years. I could probably help some of them out, right? And she comes to greet me, and I really didn't like her at all. She was peaceful, and I wasn't. She was very peaceful. And I get very emotional when I talk about her. And she always gets mad when I talk about her because she always says, Marie Kelly, it was God, it wasn't me. But it absolutely was the God in her that lit the God in me up, because there was none in me. I felt dead inside. And she had this brightness to her. And I love in the big book when Abby goes to see Bill and they talk about there was something about his eyes and you can't explain it. And it also talks about, and I don't know what page it's on, but about where Bill says that that God comes to most people gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. And that was my experience. And she was just so peaceful, and she kept tilting her head to the side, and she looked like this little angel. And she said, Marie Kelly, have you ever been through the 12 steps in the big book? And I was like, who does she think she is questioning me? She's this little girl, you know? And here I am out of my mind. I can't get 3 hours sober. And I said, well, did they tell you that I had 14 years sober? And she never blinked an eye. She just stared at me. She goes, I'm going to ask you one more time with this, like, angelic voice. I'm thinking this girl's getting hit. And so anyway, I was the oldest one in there. They were all in their 20s, and they start calling me Mom. And, you know, but I stayed. And she had 3 days later, she missed her train. She really didn't talk too much about herself at all. She just kind of watched me run around like a nut. And she missed her train, and she asked me if I would give her a ride, and I did. And she got in the car, and she started talking about this this profound personality change that can go on, and how, you know, that me not drinking is not really my problem, that I have this spiritual malady, and, you know, that I can have, that I can be happy and joyous and free, that I can be free. Do you know that, you know, the drink problem can be removed? And I'm thinking, removed? How can it be removed? These are things I never heard, okay? But she gave me this little glimmer of hope. And then it was mandatory for us to make big book studies. So there was a guy running this big book study up there, and his name's Chris Brennan. Now, I got sober with Chris Brennan back in the day, and I didn't like him either, okay? So Chris Brennan's still in the meeting, and there's all these young people, and it kind of was like the greeting that I got tonight. Everybody's smiling and happy and welcome. So I'm up at this, you know, meeting, and all these young people are on fire. They're putting their hand up with like 40 days sober, saying, if anyone needs help with God in the 12 steps, I'm available. So I'm kind of like baffled and turn around like, I never saw this in AA before. Is this really an AA meeting? I was really blown away. But it was their awakened spirits that just, I was so drawn to that all of a sudden I start listening. And I remember that night, you know, I couldn't stay sober. And they were talking about page 24, about that we cannot recall at times, you know, with sufficient force. Like, me taking my mom hostage, me having a fist fight with my mom on the front lawn, you know, me waking up to my little Michael putting his hand on me and saying, thank God, I thought you were dead. That stuff is not enough. And I'm hearing stuff in AA like, just remember your last load. Remember, keep it green. I'm not remembering because I'm baffled. I love my kids. And people in AA are saying, just do it for your children. Why are you doing this? And they're whispering with my mom and passing judgment. Why can't you just do it for your kids? And that now I'm in a fist fight. I'm like, are you implying I don't love my children? I was very, very, very confused. So here I tap into this meeting and this big book. They're talking about a book that's written and there's clues. That now I have another resentment. I didn't know that the steps were in the big book. So now I'm like really resentful. I stayed in that recovery house for 90 days. I went to a concert, and I relapsed. I had my sponsor who was in that recovery house move into my house in Mayfair from the goodness of her heart, this little angel, Beverly. And she was there a week, and I left her with my family, and I stayed out for probably another year. And what happened was she told me, Marie Kelly, I'm letting you go. You have to get the gift of desperation. And I'm thinking, what is she talking? I'm like, you're letting me go. You don't let me go. And she said, you're not desperate enough. You're not willing. You keep crying about why you're getting high. You don't even know why you're getting high. I'm letting you go. And she let me go, and I went. And by God's grace, and I don't know how this ever happened, but I wound up in Temple's ICU on the weekend of Memorial Weekend 2007. And I came to with, I was beat up by the guy that I was with, and I had a brain hemorrhage, and my face was black, and I was in intensive care. And you know, we're silly people. Like, I have a big sign on the door, no visitors, except for the guy who beat me up. No visitors. So I come to, and I get a phone call from my mom that I missed my daughter's graduation from college, and that they were coming from the cemetery because a family member had passed away. And what I did was I left that hospital AMA to go do this thing one more time because I'm in pain again, and I know it's going to get me out of that pain. And I went to the hospital, and I left the hospital and went back to this guy's house, and there was probably $1,000 worth of stuff. And I started doing what we were doing. And in the middle of it, and I don't know about any of you, but when I start, I don't stop. And in the middle of doing what we were doing, I looked at him and I said, I'm a really sick girl and I'm going to die. And I drug my butt into Holy Family College, and Chris Brennan was standing there looking at me. And he looked at me and put his arms around me and he said, Marie Kelly, we love you and you're dying. We're watching you die. He said, you're not allowed to talk in my meeting. He said, I want you to sit down. He said, we know you know. You think you know everything. You can't get a minute sober and you're dying in front of our eyes. And what happened was I went through the steps very, very quickly, and I had friends that owned a recovery house, and I went through the 12 steps in 3 weeks and never had an obsession to drink or to use drugs again. That obsession has never come back. I have never, ever, I don't even think about it. The problem was removed immediately. It was profound. It happened. It has never come back. Now, obviously, there's certain things that are required to stay in that state. But these guys made me go down to a girls' recovery house and start sponsoring people at 3 weeks sober. And that's what I did. And that was another thing that was against everything that I was ever taught or believed. I was going down 4th and Lombard, and there were people there that had 20 years sober, and I didn't know. And I was like, have you ever been through the 12 steps? Can I sponsor you? Like, I was so excited about this obsession being removed. I would have 12-stepped the bus driver. Anybody that walked by, I was telling people in CVS, I'm like, you cannot believe what happened to me. Because when I think about the time going in and out of treatment centers, and I think they're necessary, but it was the language of the heart. It was one alcoholic with another alcoholic sitting down with me and telling me what my problem was, and here's your answer. And I was scared to sponsor people, and they highlighted my big book, and they made me go down. And that it was in the teaching that I learned it. And I started practicing to live it. And it was painful, and I didn't have my son. But I can't explain in my heart that obsession being removed blew my mind. And I knew that I was tapped into this thing that was so amazing. And, you know, they explained to me about the allergy of the body and the mental obsession. Like, I didn't know any of that. And I was mad at God. And Beverly said to me, well, you don't like this God. AA is saying you can pick any God you want. You make the idea of God up. You know, as long as it's not you. I was like, okay, that sounds good. And my ideas about God that I was praying to, I was so mad at him. She said, let's push all this aside. Just make up a little idea of what it is you want God to be. She said, just jot some things down. And I did. She said, now that's the God you're going to pray to. You know, are you willing to believe? I'm like, well, not really, because I was really. She said, are you willing to believe something happened for me? And I said, absolutely. She moved me right or wrong. There was no just let's keep moving. You know, and that step three was just a decision. And then I had to quit playing God. You know, I didn't even know I was playing God. You know, and she explained to me, and the part I love the most about the third step was that he is our father and we're his children. And that children go to their father for everything they can't provide on their own. I got that. He is the father. And she explained in step two, he's everything or he's nothing. And I remember being early sober and sitting and just meditating on that. I would sit and be like shaking and scared and, all right, God, you're everything. You're everything. Because if you're not everything, then you're nothing. And I don't want you to be nothing. So it was this thing, but I started reading it and highlighting stuff. And I started chasing these big book studies. And I didn't have my son. And I was on 95 five times a day. I didn't have a job. And I would get down that girl's recovery house and I would sit with them and just welcome them. I didn't even know that I was working with others, but it was getting me out of me and I was learning this book, you know. Then I had to do this fourth step and I did so many fourth steps. She said, let's just do one on your husband because you're kind of really mad at him. So we did that, you know. And, man, I got to see that it, you know, I would have left me too. I would have left me too. I played this victim. And she just kept saying to me, and you know what? I never get mad at her. She said to me, I'm never going to be on your side. I don't want her to. She's got a good sponsor, you know? And she said to me, Marie Kelly, you're just a victim, and victims don't recover. And I wanted to get better. I'm thinking, where are we going with all this? This is amazing stuff. And I got a job, and I got a little job making very little money. It's hard for us to come down. I was making 20-some dollars an hour. Now I'm working in a doctor's office and driving 45 minutes with this resentment every day. 45 minutes, because the old job, Amtrak's 3 minutes. I could walk. Now I'm driving. God, who can I help? Let me serve you, God. You know, not even really with a happy heart, but I would do it. And it's almost like this way of life, I was attracted to it. I didn't know how to live it. And then all of a sudden, it just came a part of my life. I was able to see my son every week. And we wound up in a very, very, very expensive custody battle. I share this with you because we can get over anything. This was a man that I loved. I paid him child support, and he is now a millionaire. And I used to say, and he's taken it. How dare him take it? It's all an opportunity to get closer to God. I had to keep doing it. I heard Sandy Beach say, and I never forgot it, forgive when the injustice is happening. And I continued to try to let my ex-husband see the God that I have in my heart. And I taught my son. That's what I tried to do. I believe a lot of this has to go on in our own homes. You know, in our own homes. And to just be an example. Be an example constantly. And this custody battle was ridiculous. At almost 3 years sober, I was forced to go for hair follicle drug testing. I had to pay for it. I had to go to counseling once a week and pay $200 an hour. We had to split that. And there was a lot of bashing going on and attacking parenting. And every day I showed up and tried to bring my awakened spirit in there. And I want to share with you on a nicer note, that him and I, this was the man I loved. Something happened. I don't know what happened to him, but he's not the same man. And he called me on Saturday on Christmas Eve, and he said, hey, I heard you're having a party. Would you like to pick Michael up a day early? And I believe that all that being nice was worth that one phone call. Because how do I know when someone else is just going to get it? How do I know? And I always say this to the girls I'm sponsoring all the time. You never know who's watching you. We're working for God today. We're working for God. It has nothing to do with us. You know, people call, oh, well, they didn't say thank you. Who cares? God sees it. That's the real deal. And, you know, and I had to make amends, and I had a ton of amends, and I had these neighbors that worried sick about me, called DHS on me. I resented them. How dare they call DHS on me? My sponsor said to me, do you think for 1 minute that they were concerned about your child? No, I never thought that for 1 minute. You betrayed me. You called. They called my family. And so these neighbors, some of them were elderly, and when I was sober before, I would cook for them and all, and now I'm robbing them. I'm knocking at their door, and I'm making up lies. You got to give me $40. You have to give me $60. And I was sober about 35, 40 days, and I would pull up, and I just couldn't look them in the eye. And what I did was I went to every neighbor, and I made my amends, and it was a beautiful thing. And I'll tell you what. So many of us are afraid to make amends, you know. And I was taught that the harm's already done. This is about making the wrong right. You already hurt them. There's nothing to be afraid of. When I made amends that day on my street, it was such a trickle effect that I just kept knocking on all the doors. Like you couldn't stop. And I still had a black and blue face, you know. And you think, how can I do this? I can't afford not to do that. I have to do it. One of the big amends that I had was to my mom financially. I owed my mom over $50,000. And when I got divorced from my husband, I got a nice little divorce settlement. And I'm saying this for a reason. I'm very selfish and self-centered. Very. Because when I went to write that check, I owed my mom at least $50,000. I didn't want to give it to her. I was like, as I'm writing the check, I'm like, wow, this is a lot of money. Didn't want to do it. Didn't want to do it. Probably owe her, ruined her credit, ruined my daughter's credit. I did a lot. I ruined my daughter's credit sober because of the greed that I had to have more and more credit cards. Let me just borrow your Social Security number. These are things, who borrows people's Social Security numbers? But these are the things that I did when I'm not standing in the sunlight of the Spirit. This is who I become. See, I could be horrible sober, and I have to remember that. So I made a lot of these amends, and, you know, I'm not good at all with step 10. I'm getting better at it. It's a tough one for me. I'm pretty faithful with 11. I'm pretty good with that. And I love sponsoring women. Absolutely love it. And I'll never, ever, no matter what. I do 3 meetings a week that are big book studies, and I will bring people back to my house. It is not unusual at all for my children to see a house full of AA people. We are around my dining room table. We are on our knees doing the 3rd-step prayer, 7th-step prayer. My kids don't go like, ooh, what are you doing? No, because my kids know that their life is dependent on that, because I'm their mom and I'm here, and they know that this is absolutely what works. I have had several sponsees die. I had a sponsee murdered. I mean, it's not always easy working with new people. It's not. I've been stolen from. I've had checks stolen from my house. And I'll tell you what, and this is from my heart, my door will continue to be open for Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if they needed that money, that's okay. What I have been given, you can't buy. I shared with you a lot about my marriage in the beginning and where I am now. Because all that stuff that I had, the money, the romance, the sure house, and all those material things, brand new cars, were all taken away in a minute. My dependency was on that, not on God. And today, I have the same job that I got 4 years ago, In 4 years, I got a dollar an hour raise. And you know what they told me? Don't tell anybody we gave you a raise. I said, okay, I won't. Thanks. But every day I ask God, let me go in. See, because it's not just, it says constant thought of others. It's just not about constant thought of others in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in my place of employment. It's with my neighbor that parks their car where I'm going to park mine. It's all that stuff. I have to be that light of God that people need to see, no matter what. I can't afford not to do it. And I don't like when I feel uncomfortable. And I know tonight on the way down here, these girls were late. That upset me. And I'm like, why are you late? Why are you late? It's irresponsible to be late. Listen, immediately as my mouth was opening, I felt very uncomfortable. I had to immediately make an amends. Okay? I don't like feeling that way. I don't like, because that's the old person, and I don't like it. I was able to buy a house. My brothers, you know, really, you know, I was wanted by the police. Listen, it was not a good scene. I put my family through hell, and I had a lot of amends to make. And I had to make amends to my brother who, you know, they worried about my mother. They worried about my kids. I affected his marriage. I stole peace of mind. I stole sanity. I just really, really was not the big sister that they once knew. And I was able to purchase a home on my brother's street. And I'm now my brother's neighbor who lives five doors down from me. And, you know, and everyone's just pleased in my family with Alcoholics Anonymous. I can tell you that. I'm going to end with this. But one of the greatest amends I'm making right now, I'm going to talk about my mom for a minute. And this is what AA did for my family. My mom could never understand how I couldn't get sober again. So Chris Brennan said to my mom, you know, Mrs. McKay, why don't you come to some of our big book studies? And my mom started to come. Mm-hmm. Well, now, over 3.5 years later, my mom is part of our Ron and Dittman group on Wednesday night. And she sits right up front, and she has her own big book, and she has a nickname, Big Dog, and her name's right on the book, and she's really a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that gave her an ability to forgive and to understand the disease. Because, you know, our families are baffled. Why? What's wrong with you? We don't even know what's wrong with us. And my mom, on September 2nd, moved in with me. She was going to help out. My brother's down the street with the kids, and, you know, Michael's 14. And she's like, I can't wait. We're going to put the coffee on. I'm going to make dinner. And she was excited. Now, 74 years old, she looks 60 and literally could run circles around most of us. She's amazing energy, never sick. And 10 days later, she was diagnosed, not a symptom. She was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer and brain cancer. And I talked to Sarah about this, that my mom was divinely placed in my home. I don't have a doubt in my mind. She keeps saying, I feel like somebody played a trick on us. My mom was placed in my home because I'm getting to take care of her. And this job that I complained about so much didn't even make me fill family leave papers out. They said, just, I'm not getting paid, but that's okay. Because they're telling me, just take the time you need. And my boss, who's the head of the practice, has become a very good friend of mine. And when I'm scared to give her more medicine, because sometimes her pain's out of control, I'm like scared. And I'll text him and say, can I give her, you know, something else? And everyone's just been available. And I'm getting to see, like, the God everywhere with this. And how about this? I'm the alcoholic, drug addict, crack addict, giving my mom Oxycontin and Percocet and Xanax. And when I tell you the problem has been removed, and I said to my brothers, I don't want any of you guys to worry, and I want you to know, because I'm so good at taking drug tests these days. I said to my brothers, look, if you're ever concerned or, you know, my amends to you is to always keep you comfortable. If you ever want me to take a drug test, and they were insulted that I said it. And that's the amazing grace of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm getting to take care of my mom. We lay in bed in the middle of the night. She has not slept in her bed since she got. We gave her a room, but she's in my bed. She doesn't want to leave. And I hold her, and we pray together. We do the 11 step together. You can't buy it. You cannot buy it. And, you know, as much as I see my siblings, and sometimes I feel a little overwhelmed, and if they only knew, like, I'm tired sometimes. I don't want them to know. God assigned this job to me. This is my new assignment, you know. And I know she's going to die. It's a terminal diagnosis. I've had to keep a lot of secrets from her because she keeps saying she doesn't want to know. And I'm trying to honor that. And as she's a little bit mad at God, just a little, and I let her go. And then I gently and lovingly talk to her about God. And it's amazing. I don't have to force my God on her. But I lay with her and I hold her and I love her. And if it wasn't for my mother, and my mother went to Al-Anon, and my mother would go down on me, and she said, I'm not listening to them. That's my daughter. I'm chasing her. And my mother used to come to crack houses and kick the door in and drive the car up on the pavement. You know what it's like when you're partying and somebody's got laying on a horn and they just don't get off and the horn's blowing? And, you know, she really tried to interrupt my partying is what I'm saying. And she would go to Al-Anon, but she followed her heart. And I'm grateful to my mother because my mother did chase me and in snowstorms and everything. And she never gave up on me. And this is by far the greatest amends that any of us can ever do. You know what I mean? It's got to be done in the home first. I totally believe that. I believe that going to meetings and doing step work and all that is very, very important. But there comes a time when our family needs us. You know, and I can't just be throwing that grilled cheese in front of the kid and running out all the time. I need to be accountable in my own home as well. And I just want to thank you all for letting me share my experience, strength, and hope. And it's an honor and a privilege to be part of Alcoholics Anonymous today. Very, very proud to be an alcoholic today. And that's all I have. Thanks.